C4. Number 20B.
We come to the chapter, Some Objections Answered. In early time it was objections to a clergyman, meaning that there were objections brought forward against her teaching. That teaching which says, oh, what you have been saying there in the chapter on signs of being is really very nice. It really sounds good, but it's not practical. This is just a nice theory, and you can believe in it, but it's not practical. It isn't really what it is. The objections here in this chapter are the objections that Christian Science is just a theory and not practical. She says that the strictures on this volume would condemn to oblivion the truth, which is raising up thousands from helplessness to strength, and is elevating them from a theoretical to a practical Christianity. So she has to show that what she has presented in the 10th chapter is a very practical chapter, that it can be demonstrated, that it is demonstrable. And you have already the point of intersection of Christianity as Christianity, namely that the realm of ideas is demonstrable, that it is improving us, that it is not just a dead theory. Therefore, what she has to show here is that theory and practice must be one, that they are not two, that there is no such dualism which says there is a nice theory, but it is not practical. Or, what is very often the case, that people say, you know, I'm a practical person, I don't know anything about the theory, and I don't care about the theory as long as I'm a practical person and I can practice it. And these empiricists are very numerous, so to say, in Christian Science. They just go along with their empiricism. They rely on experience they have, on the way they have been healing one case, and they try to heal the next 1,000 cases on the same principle as the first one. So they are empiricists, but not really scientists. Mrs. Eddy wants to show that a theory is only then a theory when it is practical. And she wants to show that the practice is only practical when it has a good theory. That these two go together. And as I have said with Popper, you know, that he is, so to say, one of those philosophers on science that bring out more and more that very point that it says science must be practical. If it is not practical, then something must be lacking about the theory. Yes, so this is here what she wants to show. She wants to show, look here, the theory is right. But if you don't take the theory as a whole, and you leave out something of the theory, then the rest of that theory is no more practical. You have to take the whole thing. You have to see that every idea reflects every other idea, and only then is that idea a powerful idea, a practical idea, an idea that demonstrates itself. Very often here we find Mrs. Eddy's showing that statement must be followed by proof, or else the statement is not right, but also that proof must be followed by statement, or else you don't know what kind of proof you have. This is exactly what she did there in the 6th chapter. You see that she said, I have been healed, I had the proof, but I must know the statement to it. I must know the science of it. She was asking for the statement, and could see only if she puts proof together with statement, that statement could proved again, could be proved again. Else, it is just one accidental proof or experience, and that's that. That's the end of it. But if we find for an experience a reasoning, a theory, a law, a principle, then we can apply that principle again, and it can again be proved. which says that demonstration and spiritual understanding are God's immortal keynotes. Proof and understanding. Understanding and proof. Proof followed by understanding. Understanding followed by proof. You have that all through the textbook, that you can have a higher understanding by studying, but you can also gain a higher understanding by proof. That for the disciples of Jesus, they only gained a higher understanding after they saw the proof of Jesus. Before that, they couldn't quite understand what he was driving at. But when he showed the proof of resurrection and ascension, they began to believe. They began to see what he was driving at. So both are necessary. Here in Objections Answers, she really asks, now, what is it that prevents demonstration? Why is it that I give a wonderful theory and that some cannot demonstrate it? What prevents demonstration? And the answer that she gives is quite unique, and she uses two terms which she doesn't use in any other chapter. She says the answer is consistency and coherency. Consistency of the idea, coherency of the idea. What does consistency mean? It means union, hence that which stands together as a united whole. Do you get the tone? This is that which demonstrate, that which enables demonstration is consistency, the uniting of all ideas to a whole, where there is no lack, no break, no gap. Consistency is also defined a degree of resistance to separation of constituent particles. Everything that resists separation of that which should belong together and makes it a coherent whole is preventing demonstration. Or coherency, if the definition runs, that it means connection or congruity arising from some common principle or relationship, making a logical whole. Can you see, both consistency and coherency have a sense, the parts must make together a whole. You can't leave the parts as parts. They must be brought together in consistency and coherency into a whole, and then they are demonstrable. Therefore, what prevents demonstration is an understanding of isolated ideas, which is not really understanding. Understanding really means that we see an idea in its coherency, therefore in its reflection with all other ideas. That sense that all ideas, all parts are united together into one whole, she brings out right at the beginning of the chapter, namely starting out with the whole, and that from the whole everything must come. She says, these criticisms are generally based on what? On detached sentences or clauses separated from their context. Can you see? What prevents demonstration is detaching ideas from the whole principle, detaching an idea from all the other ideas. When that happens within our understanding, that then that understanding is no more demonstrable. She says, even the scriptures, which grow in beauty and consistency from one grand root, appear contradictory when subjected to such usage. Therefore, you can prove anything you like through the Bible. Anything. You can take... prove anything you want. Be happy and merry, drink and eat. Tomorrow we are death. So let's have a good feast. Huh? Let's just live it up. Huh? The Bible says so. But it's taken out of context. Because it's taken out of context, it's a wrong interpretation. And therefore not demonstrable. Yes, so we must see, as she says, the Bible as stemming out of one grand root. If one verse, like I have quoted from, I think it's from the epistles, quoted from the epistles, is wrong the moment it's taken out of the root of the whole, out of the great purpose of the Bible. Then we see it's a wrong quotation. Actually, it's a quotation from a Greek writer of that time that said that very thing. But people read it there in the Bible and say, hey, it's in the Bible. Huh? And proof that with it anything. So with the textbook, if we take one sentence out of the context and try to demonstrate that, we can't. It must be interpreted as giving the characteristic of the whole. You remember we had the Gestalt theory and the Gestalt definition, which said that every part must reflect the characteristics of the whole, or else it's not true. And in order to do that, really, we need that infinite inter-reflection and interrelationship of every idea with every other idea based on that one root, the divine principle. Actually, you can see that we get here the synergy principle. That synergy principle, it says that a fact or a process is only then really powerful, more powerful, when it is united with the whole and seen as operating within the whole. That the whole is bigger than the sum of its parts. And on this tone she writes that whole chapter, that every part is a part of the whole. I will show you a few sentences afterwards. Always to think that the part is not an isolated idea, that it is a part of the whole. And think out as the whole. See, that's so true in our work. Whatever the work you do, as long as you think, what do I gain from it, you never touch Christian Science. You can use the textbook, the Bible, anything you like. If you do it by saying, what do I gain from it, you have disrupted the whole thing. You are not thinking in the synergy principle. The synergy principle says a part is only a part when it reflects the characteristic of the whole. Else it is not a part. Gives a tremendous sense today, you see, for our work and for our everything we do, that we say it's only then meaningful when it serves the whole. When it only serves me, we have disrupted the system. We have cut the garment of Christ in parts and that parted it for among the Roman soldiers. You can't do that, you see. Here in this very chapter we have that synergy principle, which trains us into thinking what is good for the idea, not what is good for us. What helps the idea, not what do I gain from it. I may only gain from it sacrifice, ridicule, persecution, I don't know what, but what does it do to the idea? That matters. That's what is under consideration. So what is it that prevents demonstration? We go quickly through the seven subjects and see what she says. And we will see that it is showing how we disrupt, really, the wholeness of that, the whole garment. In mind, you can see that she says, what is usually lacking for demonstration is that we build, really, not on scientific, not on logical reasoning. That we build, what she says, on human opinions, common sense, misrepresentation, doubtful disputations, ignorance. These are those wrong qualities which prevent demonstration. Whereas logical reasoning, reasoning with logic, would help demonstration. In spirit, we would see what really prevents demonstration if we can't make a true separation between what is real and what is unreal. If what she says, if we can't make a good separation between Adam man and the spiritual man. If we try to demonstrate spiritual man, then we must see it in a spiritual way, but we cannot demonstrate the Adam man, a better Adam man. So a great clear distinction must be made. She could have taken any other term. She has taken man and said, what do you mean by man? Do you mean by man the Adam man, or do you mean by man the spiritual man? She could have taken any other term and say, spirit first must show, or you must first be aware what kind you mean. Do you mean the material side of that term, or do you mean the spiritual value of that term? In soul, she says, what demonstrates demonstration, prevents demonstration is that we rely on the testimony of the physical senses. This is naturally the great point that we say only that is a demonstration which is proved by the testimony of the physical senses. And we like to see that demonstration. But this is a wrong concept. Who tells us what the physical senses should testify to? That would be the first question. Then just to ask, can we see the demonstration? Does the demonstration materialize itself so that we can see it? Who tells us what we should see? That's the first big question, which is never asked. Which is never asked. In principle, she says what prevents demonstration is actually the lack of science and scientific understanding, therefore also a trust and obedience in principle, trust in the principle instead of in an unknown God, and so on. Then she comes to life and says, what is it that demonstrates, prevents demonstration? It's the unwillingness to give up what she calls the ghost of materiality. She doesn't just say materiality, she says materiality actually is only a ghost, it doesn't exist. It is not something very tangible and tough that you have to give up. Actually, it's only a ghostly sense of it. It only appears to be material, as we have seen. Is matter really material? And they begin to see that matter is actually not really material. And so let's give up that ghost of materiality and the love for materiality. Else, we actually cannot demonstrate science. But why can't we demonstrate science? Because we want to demonstrate something materially. Then if we want to demonstrate something material and build up through demonstration more matter, a better, more material man, more material universe, well then we can't demonstrate science. What we want to demonstrate is that the material universe disappears. So the tendency and the motive is already wrong here, and says, therefore, you can't demonstrate that. Then in truth, we see that what prevents demonstration is a lack of coherent, consistent logic in words and deeds. Here you have the consistency, really, of consciousness, that is, without contradiction, without confusion, without absurdities. This is a great point here. You know, it really shows that consciousness must be structured, that unless we try to demonstrate a structured sense of things, we will always reason along isolated truths. And if we reason along isolated truths, they will always contradict themselves. And we get into terrific arguments. As long as we build our demonstration on arguments, we build on isolated facts and truths, and they always must contradict themselves. I say must, because if we put all the phenomena of all the various levels onto one level, namely the level of just atomistic thinking, they must contradict each other. You see, the statement God heals and the statement God does not know disease is a contradiction when it is put on the same level of reasoning, because that's not structured reasoning. Structured reasoning is if you put one statement that God heals the sick on the level of Christian Science, and you put the statement God does not know sickness on the level of absolute Christian Science, then they don't contradict each other. But that needs structured reasoning. It needs another logic. Can you see what she says actually here? Why we can't demonstrate things? Because we run always into these contradictions, into these arguments, because we are used from our schooling days and from the world's consciousness only to think atomistically and only on one level. Nobody who is sitting here in the class, perhaps with the exception of one or two, have ever been taught to think dimensionally. This was unknown in our age, absolutely unknown. We wouldn't have known what they were talking about with dimensional thinking. We wouldn't have had the faintest idea. But today we see where we have introduced all these wonderful concepts of structuring and dimensionalism, which brought light into the whole question, what is reality, and which finally resolved those contradictions, those apparent contradictions, and show that they are not contradictions, but that they are logical. I wonder sometimes if you value the education, the academic education I have given you over the last 5 years, if you have followed my teaching. I have given you the best academic education. Many of the students that go to the university have not that education which you got. They just learn the old ruts and by heart now, still, you see. The university just turned out now just the proletariat of academics. Huh? It's an academical proletariat. In the last century, they turned out the worker proletariat. Now they turn out just robots. They have learned their stuff to earn their money for no other purpose. They have not been educated to understand something. Only a few do that. Only a few. But you got it. And I wonder sometimes if you realize that you have got the academics of the right sort, which Mrs. Eddy says, huh? She said, well, that is necessary, academics of right sort. We don't need to know how a computer works, but we should need to know something about the divine idea of cybernetics. That we should know. Recently, I just a letter from a very well-trained man in what you call MIT here in Switzerland, and he has become interested in cybernetics, and he read about 10 books on cybernetics. He's a well-trained man. He said, I didn't get the idea of so easily as out of your talk, which my wife gave. He's not a Christian scientist, but his wife, and his wife gave me my talk on divine cybernetics. He said, there I got it, what cybernetics means. See, because we can reduce them to the divine idea and make it very simple, because we have a wonderful structured consciousness now. And things just fall into place. See? They fall into place. Oh, got it. I must go back to 7. The tone of love, huh? Where she says, what else is it that prevents demonstration? She says, here in love again, always the high point, that it is a lack of understanding the oneness, the unity, and the wholeness of being. A lack of seeing the whole integration of all the ideas into one whole. If we lack to see that, we always have somehow loopholes. We always have gaps. There is always a gap somewhere. Where there is no link, and then there is no link, you can't bridge it over, and you can't demonstrate it. That last statement really gives us the pith of that one root out of which the Bible grows, and that the Bible can only be understood in their various verses if that root is always considered. And so being comes out of one root. It comes out of the infinite one, and if we try to split it up, to split the infinite one up in numberless isolated ideas, then we have split up the infinite, we have split up being, then we can no more demonstrate an idea of the whole. And an idea is always an idea of the whole, because the power of the idea is always the power of the infinite. The substance of an idea is always the substance of the infinite. Never just the substance of an idea. It's always the substance of the infinite. And here Mrs. Eddy climaxes really this chapter by showing that that unity, that oneness must be kept intact, that only then we have that synergy principle, which is a thousand times more powerful than isolated ideas. She says, I and my Father are one. That is one in quality. I and my Father are one. That's what I said before. I can also say, the Father and I are one. I and the Father are one. What is the I? The power of an idea. Is one with what? With the Father. With the power of the infinite. The substance of an idea is one with the substance of the infinite, not with the substance of an isolated idea. The changelessness and identity, and the indestructible identity of an idea is the identity of the infinite, not just the identity of an idea. It's the identity of the infinite, of the whole structure of the infinite. And if we disrupt that, we can no more demonstrate the infinite. We have only an isolated idea left, and that isolated idea is no more an idea. It has become a concept. We know that from last week's work. As a drop of water is one with the ocean, we cannot separate anymore the drop of water from the ocean. If we separate a drop from the ocean, then it's no more oceanic. It's then drop-ish, huh? And it drops out of it. Huh? It's no more oceanic. A ray of light is one with the sun. Cannot be separated. Even so, God and man, Father and Son, are one in being. Can no more be separated. If we separate it, how shall we demonstrate man if he is separated from God? If we take away from man God, if we don't see man as being the man of the infinite, therefore the idea of the infinite, we cannot. Huh? For in him we live and move and have our being. One of the one I like most is the drop of water, one with the ocean. I don't know. You know, each one has his pet symbols. Huh? You can't help it. Every teacher has that. So I have mine. And I have mine because I was thinking, what does it matter if a drop is in the ocean or not in the ocean? I was looking at the window and there was a drop on the window, a raindrop, and I said, what's the difference? It's still water. Still the same chemical. H2O. Huh? What difference does it matter if it is in the ocean or not? Well, I could easily see if it is in the ocean, it's related. So it's not only a part, it's part plus relationship. What makes that relationship? That relationship gives to that part 10 times more qualities. Namely, it helps that the fish can move in it, that it can carry boats and big boats. I begin to see that the relationship gives to that part more qualities. Actually, the only real qualities, the only useful qualities. Can you see? That relationship is necessary. And if we take it away from the one principle, we lose that, and then the practicality of the idea gets lost. Yeah. So the beginning of it was that everything must stem from the one principle and not be detached from it, and it ends, again, the chapter with that oneness where Son is one with the Father, where the light, the ray of light, is one with the Son, where the drop is one with the ocean. Where we are no more a drop in the ocean. A drop, where we are the ocean. We are no more a drop, we are oceanic. We are no more isolated idea, we are the infinite idea. Yeah, so, that's that.